Welcome to the Embodiment Conference. This channel, Trauma and Social Change, it's absolutely the moment for that, isn't it? I'm Steve Hoskinson. I'm the founder of Organic Intelligence. I've been teaching in this area of trauma, embodiment, and social change for about 25 years. It's an honor, really, for us to be sponsoring this channel where we're going to hear a multiplicity of voice, all unique contributors to our collective understanding of how to move from trauma and support then social change. Our unique voice in organic intelligence has something to do with a koan that I'd like to present to you, which is trauma means unintegrated resource. And that's a koan, and if you'd like and are feeling intrigued about that riddle, then tune in to the post-trauma system development course that we are offering here. The coupon code that'll get you half off on that is ENJOY. Now, enjoy this next presentation, and we'll look forward to another meaningful time as we explore these topics, trauma and social change. Enjoy.
An integrated resource. So, welcome again to Trauma and Social Change channel, and today's session is Trauma and Trust. Rekindling trust in your body and the world. And our presenter today is Elizabeth Harborough. Elizabeth is an embodied trauma expert, psychoanalytic psychotherapist, founder of Thrive Trauma Informed Yoga, and immigrant rights activist. So it looks like we're going to talk a very interesting presentation. Thank you so much, Elizabeth. Welcome.
Thank you, David. Thank you for the lovely introduction. I am so pleased to be here with everyone, with all of you here today. And that was a lovely introduction also, and the lovely words, an integrated resource. I think it segues in a very smooth way to what we're about to talk about today, which is trust and trauma. Is something that ruptures a lot of systems, both inside and outside of us. So I would like to talk about how do we restore systems of trust in ourselves and in our bodies, and trust outside of ourselves as well. As we all know, if you're watching this particular segment and if you're watching me, you've likely been impacted by trauma, either as a provider or personally by trauma, and have felt the need, the very basic need to protect yourself. So as a therapist, I've often heard about, you know, I hear about every day the sequela of trauma in terms of avoiding things that trigger us or reliving the particular traumatic events. But one of the most distressing things that people talk to me every day about, and likely one of the most distressing things that you may encounter, is this dilemma of finding yourself in a position of restoring a sense of meaning, of trying to find a way back to shaping or wrapping your hands and arms around how do I even trust my mind? How do I trust my ability to make decisions when I can't even trust my own sense of reality? How do I, these very kind of felt, this very felt sense of, I don't even feel safe in my own skin. So they're very pervasive things that follow us that are in many ways even more distressing. And they're the things that make us human, right? Being able to trust, being able to feel like we can trust in what our environment, our relationships mean to us. So then we're left in this dilemma of, okay, I need to protect myself, right? I've been hurt or my needs haven't been met. And then how do I protect myself in a way that still leaves me open-hearted, or that leaves some space for love to come in? Because a lot of times, as you may very well know, if you're watching me, we go from one extreme, right? We start off open-hearted. If you've been in a position to be traumatized, often we hear about what's called a big T trauma or big traumatic events. And that's often what we characterize PTSD as. But I specialize in something that's called attachment trauma, which you may or may not have heard of. And attachment trauma is basically a trauma that happens in the context of an attachment relationship, or trauma that makes you feel completely alone. So when you're in a state of sadness, when you're in a state of rage, when you're in a state of complete distress, and if you were in a situation where your caregivers couldn't make you feel seen or heard, speaking of seen, you see my dog here in the background, then that's the birthplace for attachment trauma, right? Because, you know, often we think of trauma as severe abuse, severe neglect, but attachment trauma takes place when you're just not, when there's this misattunement between reality and, you know, you just feel alone even in the presence of other people. So I would, what that does in terms of our trust systems is that then we, there's a gap. We begin to not trust in what other people, not just what other people tell us, but there's this notion of epistemic trust. And epistemic trust means trust in what other people teach us. Or for example, epistemic trust, if you're interested in learning more about it, there's a wonderful person called Peter Fonagy who does extensive research in this. And he's based in London, actually. He talks a lot about trust and knowledge. So if you think about, you know, how do I know that this is white? It's likely because somebody, you know, my parent taught me that when I was a little kid, and I inherently trusted that. And then that happens because we're in a situation where if we form stable attachment relationships, then we can begin to say, okay, well, you know, this person is likely telling me that this is white, and then I can believe that this is white. Thank you for the comments about my dog. He's a puppy. He's six months old, and he has to have some epistemic trust when I try to teach him things now. So he teaches me a lot about embodied trust too. So what happens with trauma is that we begin to learn that it's not safe to learn what other people tell us. So our learning system shuts down. And what happens with that is we begin to trust people we shouldn't, and close down to people who we should, you know? And so right now you all are exemplifying some form of epistemic trust because you're listening to me and you're thinking, well, she must be speaking some degree of truth. And maybe Apollo here, my dog, is helping with epistemic trust here. Peter Fonagy's name is spelled F-O-N as in Nancy, A-G-Y, if you want to learn more about epistemic trust. So how do you restore epistemic trust? Well, one way is to think about relaxing your epistemic hypervigilance so that you can begin to trust those who, your allies, basically. So a lot of, if we think about depression, anxiety, a lot of mental health issues that come our way as a result of trauma, Peter Fonagy talks about those issues not resulting so much from, what I love about the way that he frames it is he says there are disorders in learning because our learning shuts down because we say, well, I don't want to learn from people anymore. Traumatic experience has made it so that I cannot trust that what people are telling me is true. And so I want to present to you today some antidotes to work with that precise issue. How do we then begin to open our hearts, especially in situations where some degree or a great degree of self-protection is still necessary, right? We still need to protect ourselves. So working with the body, right? I teach trauma-informed yoga for a reason. Working with the body, with something that's called interoception. If you haven't heard that word, it means the ability to feel your body from the inside. So right now, wherever you're seated, if you wish, you can either close your eyes or keep your eyes open. And if, again, if you hear background noise, it's my puppy. If it makes you feel dissociated or just too activated to shut your eyes, please keep your eyes open and maybe focus on one spot. If you like, you can stand up. And then maybe in this moment, if you like, you can bring your hands to your heart center, one hand, two hands. And then maybe notice just the rate of your heart beating in this moment. And as you notice that you're practicing something that's called interoception. So maybe continuing to notice your heart rate, your breathing rate. For just a couple of more breaths, maybe noticing as you take a breath in, if your heart speeds up a little bit as you take a breath out, you might notice that your heart slows down just a bit. And then if you like, if you're standing up, you may sit down, or if you're seated, you can open your eyes if your eyes have been closed. And I see in the chat, somebody makes a very wise comment about politicians. It's hard to trust these days. And I wanted to really comment about that as well, that there is, especially now with systemic racism and systemic trauma coming to a forefront, especially here in the United States, and certainly it's a worldwide issue. How do we meet this dilemma of trusting our bodies, of trusting the world? I would say one of the antidotes is beginning to trust in your body so that you can choose people who are safe in your community, who are safe in your own either family. Sometimes family is a very unsafe place to be, but safe within your own community so that you can resort to them. And then whether there be teachers or healers, and sometimes we shut down to them, right? Because we become a one-person closed system. So I have some practices that you can, if you want, you can engage in. One practice can be practice asking for help once a week from somebody who is safe in your mind. It can be a friend. It can be somebody in your community, in your spiritual community. It could be help, asking for help with something that is very, very simple. So starting very small, often those of us who struggle with trusting, especially with epistemic trust and trauma, we don't like to ask for help. We shut down. We, especially during times of distress, we isolate, right? So when we practice with asking for help and make it a weekly practice and say, and identifying ahead of time, I'm going to ask for help with taking out the trash or groceries or something with a specific member in my community, especially when we've been taught to mistrust people in our own community because we've been taught to devalue them, especially if you come from a marginalized community, right? I think that that becomes a very important practice. Now, secondly, if you practice writing a letter to your self-protective part, right? And view that part not as an enemy, the part of you that makes you at times feel shut down, like you cannot trust anybody else, and that you can relate to that part and maybe even name it. That's my self-protector. That's that part means well, but sometimes it makes you shut down and walls you off so that you feel completely alone and don't let people in. So if you feel that that may be the case for you, writing a letter to that part of you with and working with it, not so that you can, you know, seeing that part of you as a winter coat that you need during the winter. But if you go out during the summer with a winter coat, you're going to be very hot, right? So those in psychology, we call them psychological defenses. We have protective defenses for a reason. We need them. So how can you maybe begin to develop a relationship with a part of you that mistrusts and develop a relationship with that part of you that is wise, that is compassionate? You can write a letter to it. You can maybe sometimes when it tells you to, okay, it's not safe to reach out to anyone. I can't trust my therapist. I can't trust my healer. I can't trust my friend, to maybe say, well, I know that you mean well right now. I know you mean well. I know you mean to protect me, but is right now what you're saying isn't altogether all that helpful. I need to be able to let this person in at least maybe 20%. So trauma also makes us resort to what I call all or nothing thinking, right? Black or white thinking, especially with trust. I either trust all the way and I let anyone in and I open my heart fully, or I shut myself down. I don't let anyone in. And if you have experience of your trauma, you likely know what I'm talking about. I let in the wrong person. They hurt me. I may do that again. And then I shut down because then I don't want to be hurt again at all. And I shut down completely. So how do I develop that flexibility of heart, that flexibility of mind, so that I know how to move between protecting myself and then restoring trust? Because when the trust I'm talking about isn't just being open-hearted, right? Just letting anyone in. We have to have boundaries, right? We have to have some sense of self-compassion. So one practice that I like to teach you that could just maybe enhance or embody that sense of moving back and forth between open-heartedness and self-protection is what I call, it's just a very simple seated cat-cow shape. So if you like, you can join me in doing this. You can either stay still where you are, or you can begin to move in these very gentle undulating movements when you're ready, very simply syncing up your breath with your next breath in. Maybe, so I'm going to move my computer a little bit further away. So you see, I have my hands on my knees right now. My feet are touching the ground. I think the light makes it harder to see me. And then as you breathe in, maybe you lean forward. And if your neck allows, maybe look up slightly, not too much. So this embodies this. As you breathe in, you take in oxygen. So you're taking in with your heart, leaning forward, allowing space breath to come in, and then curving into yourself, maybe tucking your chin in, rounding, protecting your body, protecting your heart, protecting yourself, and then moving back and forth between these two shapes. Inhaling forward as you arch, exhaling, maybe straightening your arms, curving, perhaps feeling. So I mentioned interoception before. Interoception is building a relationship with feeling sensations in your body. And trauma research shows us that the stronger we feel sensations in our body, the more intensely we feel them, the better we are at identifying our emotional state. And then that can cue us in as to, well, can I trust this situation? Can I trust this person? Am I anxious? But maybe as you reach forward, you feel a stretching sensation across your collarbones, maybe your throat opens. You can turn this into your very own rhythm. You can move faster than me, slower than me. Your eyes can be open or closed. And I'd like to invite you to be very aware to the choices that you make, because trauma takes away your capacity to choose. And in this moment, you have complete control in every moment of our practice together, of how fast you move, how slow you move, how much breath you take in, how much of this moment you take in, and then as you exhale, how much you want to expel, take out, protect, curve into yourself. And then maybe doing this 5 more times, if you like, knowing you can stop at any moment for any reason. You might hear my little puppy in the background. He really wants to join us. He's outside now playing. And we, perhaps still, if you get distracted, coming back to sensations, a flexibility in your thoracic spine. So your body is capable of opening and closing. It's not rigid. It's not stuck. Our minds can make us believe that we're stuck in behind a wall, or in a continuously open state where we'll be hurt, where we cannot protect ourselves. And this can be a practice to remind you at any point, when you want, you can come back to center. And then maybe just finding a center here, taking a few breaths, feeling the pliable, flexible nature of your heart, of your rib cage, your lungs. They are capable of opening, of closing, just like you are. So restoring trust is not a linear process, right? Sometimes we'll be more open, sometimes we'll be more walled off. Just like sometimes our rib cage will feel sticky, will feel, our breath will feel like it's stagnating, like it's not coming in fully. But you can practice with this at any point. And when you're about to, you know, when you're in public transport, when you're in the car, when you're at home, to remind yourself that you're not stuck, that you can protect yourself, that you can open up, that you can move between these two regions, that you can make these movements as big, as small as you want them, and you have complete control over this situation at your own pace, as big, as small as you want the movements to be, right? Open, close. And then sometimes if you want to practice, if you're going into a situation where you know you need more protection, you can be here for a while, feeling the stretching sensations in the back, your upper back, the stretching in the back of your neck. You could even perhaps imagine an armor around your body, mind, that still allows you to see people, to let their voice in, but that doesn't permeate your internal boundary, your heart, right? You're still protecting your heart so that you can trust, but remain protected. Now, another practice that I'd like to offer you is also, it's called a loving kindness body scan. So I want to present to you just very practical things that you can do that are embodied, right? Because you've probably heard a lot of theory, and if you've been on a healing journey from or with your trauma journey, then don't want to bore you a lot with theoretical things. So again, for this next piece, you can either stand up or you can stay seated, whatever choice you want to make. If it feels like you would feel more grounded by standing up, you can certainly stand up. I am choosing to stay seated, and I will just walk you through an abbreviated practice of this. So a loving kindness meditation for your body scan. And again, you can keep your eyes open or you can close them. And another important thing about trust that I would like to remind you in these embodied practices is that you can always change your mind. So a lot of times trauma makes us feel that we're stuck, and I'm repeating that over and over again because you likely know that this is true, that we feel stuck in a situation, in a relationship. If I say yes, then I have to do this. And if I say no, then now it's too late to say yes. And now I'm stuck in this horrible relationship. And now I'm stuck in this horrible situation again and again and again. And I'm stuck in this pattern again and again and again. And the truth is that we and you and all of us can change our minds at any point for any reason. And I'll remind you of that in our embodied practices, because I think these practices are powerful in that we can take them outside this room into our relationships and say, oh, I can change my mind. The voice of trauma is telling me that I can't, but I actually can. So again, if you started standing up and would rather sit down, you can sit down, or vice versa. Eyes open, you can close them. You can choose to experiment with one option or the other. Just remind yourself that you're not stuck. You don't have to stick with one decision. And then maybe now, if you like, you can bring attention to your feet. And if you like, feeling for bringing attention to your feet, to the sensations, especially around your toes, the soles of your feet. And the invitation is to feel for bringing attention to the soles of your feet, your toes, not as if you were looking at the sensations from the outside or from above, as if you were really inside your body, inside the sensations, inside the tingling, the pressure. If your feet are touching the ground, the warmth, the pressure, the weight shifting. Feeling the sensations from the inside of your feet. Continuing to breathe. Knowing that if you need to move around, you're always free to move around. And then if you'd like, you can silently repeat to yourself, may my feet be filled with ease. May my feet be well. May my feet be at ease and happy. Just continuing to notice sensations in your feet as you say those things to yourself. If your mind wanders off or you resist those phrases, that's fine. If you like another phrase, you can also send another phrase to your feet. And then maybe moving on to your lower legs. Noticing sensations in your calf muscles, in the front of your low legs. I've been hiking here in the mountains in North Carolina, and so I feel a lot of kind of twitching and soreness there. You might feel different sensations. Some of us might feel nothing at all there. That's very poignant. That's okay too. And then maybe as you take your next inhale, saying to yourself, may my lower legs be filled with ease. May I trust that my low legs support me. May my low legs be well. And may my low legs be happy. If you want, transferring that attention very slowly to your upper legs. Now we're doing an abbreviated version of this, but at home you can make this last 30 minutes if you like, or longer, onto your upper legs. So your legs are your fountain of support, right? Your fountain of the vehicle with which you walk the earth. So really feeling sensations in your upper legs. If you're seated, you might notice the back of your legs touching your chair. May my upper legs be filled with health and ease. May I learn to trust that my upper legs can support me, can walk me in the direction I need to be headed in. May my upper legs be filled with peace and wellness, and may they be happy. Just noticing, continuing to notice sensations in your legs. Maybe moving awareness to your torso, to your abdomen, your back. Torso supports your vital organs, especially your digestive system, your vagus nerve that tells you when something's dangerous, when something is off. It gives us what we call here in the States a gut feeling. All of that area, notice sensations there. If your belly is tensing up, if you feel any hardness, or just noticing without any judgment. And then when you're ready, may my belly, my abdomen be filled with wisdom. May I learn to listen to my gut feeling and to trust it. May my back support me. And the vital functions of my organs. May my spine and my belly be happy and healthy. Then, if you like, you can move up to your heart center. If it helps to connect to your heart center, you may even want to place one hand or two hands there, just like we did initially at the beginning of our segment together. May my, just noticing here before we actually send the loving kindness there, how your breath perhaps travels and makes your chest or upper back rise and fall. May my heart, upper back, chest be well. May I learn to trust in its flexibility and vitality. May my heart be happy. And may my heart be protected and open at the same time. I'll say that again. May my heart be protected and open at the same time. Then, if you like, you can move your attention up to your throat. If it feels comforting to have your hand there, you might, maybe not. Again, knowing you can move at any point, if this starts to feel a little uncomfortable to be still this long, you can roll your shoulders if you like. May my throat and voice be strong and well. May I learn to trust in the truth of my voice. May my throat and voice be happy. And then moving up to your face, head. Some of us find it quite comforting to have our hands on our face. If this is something that you find comforting, you might choose to try that. Otherwise, your hands can be resting. My face, head, be at ease, be well. May it be held. May it be happy. And if your hands have been up, you're welcome to rest them down. Maybe take a few breaths. If you like to stretch in any way, you're welcome to do that. If your eyes have been closed, you're welcome to let in the sights in the room that you're in currently. It's very slowly allowing yourself to come back. And just trusting in what you see in the air that you're breathing. And then I'd like to offer one last practice before we're out of time. One key way to restore epistemic trust, and the trust in what we know and what our minds know about ourselves and others, is to cultivate what's called a mentalizing stance. Mentalizing is the ability to be with the heart and minds of other people and our own hearts and minds. So often, if you find yourself reacting or falling into a reactive stance when you're triggered, you are likely, and not just you, but all of us have lapses in mentalizing. We can go to hyper-mentalizing, which is when we go into this, I know that she's angry with me, but she's not telling me. When we go into the, what's called a pathological certainty. And often when we're in trauma, we tend to do that, right? We tend to guess other people's mind states, especially if we had to survive our families by doing that. If we grew up with volatile parents and we had to survive the mood, we had to guess the mood of our household a lot, we may end up doing that with our partners and making assumptions that are completely wrong. So developing a mentalizing stance, first by moving into these embodied practices, being with ourselves, so then we can gauge how we feel in our bodies, how we feel in our minds, and then ask ourselves, doing a, what I call the mentalizing daily check-in, which is composed of three very simple questions. What's difficult about these simple questions, sometimes the simple things are, can be difficult to do and to practice, right? And I like to think of this as a check-in, like brushing your teeth, doing this maybe two or three times a day and asking yourself the question, to mentalize yourself, to think about how you're doing. Often when we're in trauma, we don't mentalize ourselves, we react, especially when triggered. So asking yourself question number one, what am I thinking? Question number two, what am I feeling? And question number three, is there anything I need to do about it? A lot of times we react and we haven't even realized, I'm thinking that my spouse might be very angry with me. Number two, I'm feeling afraid. Number three, is there anything I need to do about it? Maybe I need to calm down, do a body scan, and then check in with him or her or them about my assumption. Hey, I noticed that you pulled away. Were you angry with me? So asking these three questions to ourselves might enable us to mentalize the other better so that we can trust our own reality and trust the other person a bit better. And rather than saying, I know you're angry with me, and often we can be triggered by something from our past and go into this hypermentalizing stance and be reactive. So that's antidote number three. And again, as a review, antidote number one, practicing reaching out to people in your community, which is easier said than done, especially when we cave into ourselves. Embodied practices are a fundamental piece of that work. And daily mentalizing check-in, also relating to your self-protective part with compassion, right? We don't trust for a valid reason. And then learning to use that piece of yourself as a wise piece, as something that you can consult with and resort to, but then also having an open yet protected heart is remembering that's a lifelong practice. So remembering also to be very compassionate with yourself as you engage in this practice and seeing it as a practice, just like you see your spiritual practices as a practice, or your meditation or trauma journey is a practice. That's the way that I like to see it, at least. So it's been a pleasure to be with you, and I'd like to have some time to maybe for questions.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. Can you hear me okay, just to check?
I can hear you great, David.
Fantastic. Okay, so we've got quite a number of questions that came in for you. That was a really powerful session so far. Thank you. So for people with chronic disease, can you please comment on how to build trust in your body when your body is regularly failing you, so to speak, and doesn't feel a safe space?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a wonderful and very powerful question, especially when your body does not feel like a safe home, right? It doesn't feel like a safe place. And I would recommend engaging in embodied practices, such as when I work with people with chronic illness and chronic pain, we engage in practices that that actually integrate. We're talking about trauma as a force that kind of divides and conquers, right? So if you can engage in practices that help you feel the parts of your body that are healthy. So often, you know, we tend to focus on parts of our bodies that are ill, and there are parts of our bodies that are healthy and that function well at the same time, or that parts of our bodies that are in chronic pain, and then also parts of our bodies that at the same time, and this is called dialectics, right? That we can hold, we can expand our container. And there's a practice that I teach for people with chronic illness, which is feeling your breath up and expanding your, and feeling for widening your shoulder blades and expanding your bodily container so that you're able to contain the parts of you that are ill and the parts of you that are well. Maybe it's your mind that's feeling well, or your heart that's your willpower, your resilience that feels strong, so that you can contain that part as well as the parts of you that are ill. And we are capable of expanding our container to embody, to hold all those parts compassionately. And we can do that even while laying down, even when we're under excruciating pain. And we have flare-ups as for people with chronic illness are able to do this even on, you know, if they're bedbound. And it is hard. It is hard to trust a body that keeps failing you, that's not there for you, that betrays you, that feels like it's betraying you over and over again. So developing a relationship with it that is compassionate and that is like, hey, I can hold your darkness and I can hold your light, and I can learn to do that over time. And I don't want to simplify it, but it's a really tough thing to do.
Thank you, Elizabeth. There's a question. If trauma has been present for many years, for example, 45 years plus, and trust was compromised way back then, is it much more challenging to release trauma from our bodies? Is it much more challenging to regain trust? And I guess there's the additional question of how could you promote better trust there or improve that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would say that it is difficult the longer that it's been there. I would say that it's difficult. It depends on the person, right? It depends on how long you've been with it. 45 years is a long time. 45 years is a long time to be with trauma, to feel shut down, to feel like you cannot trust people. However, I work with people who are in their 70s who are healing from trauma, and it takes time, but I've seen their hearts begin to soften, their interactions with themselves and with their significant others in their life begin to open up little by little. And it's like a window opening. It's like air coming in. And these are actual words that I've heard from people. You know, it's like, oh, it feels like oxygen's finally coming into my into my body, into like that little conversation could have gone this way, but it went that way instead. I chose a different route for that conversation, and I feel completely different in this moment because I chose to trust that that person wasn't angry with me in that moment. And it doesn't look like dramatic healing moments sometimes. It looks like little tiny imperceptible blips at times, right? Like you say yes to somebody offering to carry the groceries for you, and then you realize, wow, I would have never done that 6 months ago. That's how progress looks like a lot of times in trauma healing, in restoring trust. So don't discard the little tiny steps. I call them wins, the little wins. So maybe look back on your week and think about what wins did I have this past week? Because trauma makes us think of just the things we do wrong over and over and over again.
Thank you, Elizabeth. So there's a question, is this mistrust of learning at a subconscious level?
That's a great question too. These are wonderful questions from all the attendants. It's both, it's conscious and subconscious. For a lot of people sometimes might think, oh, I'm a very trusting person consciously, right? But then they might not be so trusting. You might see people who seem very open-hearted, who might have tons of friends, who might hug you and who might be very friendly. But then when it comes to true intimacy, to letting you in, you might feel pretty pushed away by them, or like they're not capable of very of deep intimacy because there might be a lot of fear there. You might relate to that as well. They're like, oh, I don't know where this is coming from. Or people might tell you too, like, why are you pushing me away? Or why won't you let me in? Or so that's when the unconscious trust, difficulty with trust comes in. So it could be at both levels concurrently at the same time.
So just say that the time's coming along a bit with the session. So I'm just going to have a little transition and reference some what's coming up. And then if we've got a few more minutes at the end, then we can come back to the questions.
Sounds great.
Superb. Thank you so much for delivering such a potent talk on such a strong topic as well. I noticed in the chat just how many affirmations were coming up from attendees with gratitude and sharing kind of ahas. Mm-hmm. And so if you want to contact Elizabeth, her website is elizabetharborough.com. And also if you want to continue the conversation, you can go to the coffee room where the link will be in the chat here. And also if you go to the Embodiment Conference Facebook link, which is also in the chat here. Coming up next, you've got A Radical Approach for Working with Shame and the Body with Lawrence Heller. That's also in the Trauma and Social Change channel. So these sessions are live and free and also available on recording for the next 48 hours. The obvious next step is to purchase the library to be able to digest these at your leisure and be able to take a gentler pace. It's been a pretty intense journey so far with all of these sessions. It's twice as expensive after the conference, so it's excellent to get these now. And if there are people who are working with trauma professionally, you can get a discount if you just message us and reach out. So with the remainder of the session, we actually have another 4 minutes. That's gone quickly, so we can go for a few more questions if you'd like, Elizabeth.
Okay.
Question here. I'm an autistic 30-year-old. I've been developing a social life and discovered during lockdown that two old friends were sexual abusers. How can you cultivate trust in friends and making new friends?
Okay, yes, that's a wonderful question too. Well, I would say by practice making friends and, cultivating peace, is that word sticks out to me in that question. That's a beautiful word, cultivating. It's like cultivating a plant, right? You cultivate something that you want to grow. And so you cultivate by making small steps. You cultivate by making small steps, not going all in at one time. And so making small steps, going out with a friend to maybe having a small conversation with a friend, having a positive experience with that friend, and then building on that positive experience. And that's how we build friendships over time, right? You think, oh, okay, you feel from that friend that you can trust them, and then you give them a little bit more. And there's this wonderful notion that comes from Brené Brown here in the States, and it's called, I like to use it, it's called a trust jar. And so marble jar. So you can think of trust like somebody puts a little marble in your marble jar. And usually the way that we build trust in other people isn't when people do something big, right? It's when people do something small, like they say, I'm going to take out the trash today. And they actually do it. They say, they do what they say they're going to do. And then that's how we begin to trust people. And we trust that they actually see us. The other, and then that's a marble in their marble jar, right? And then we empty their jar when we don't feel like they're following through, when we don't feel like they get us. Another way we build trust in people is when we feel like, oh, this person is reflecting back to me the way I feel. So if you say, I've had a really horrible day, and then your friend, your new friend says to you, oh, I'm so sorry you've had a bad day, then maybe you start to feel, oh, I want to do more things and start to build on deepening this friendship and tell them more about my personal story. And then you deepen. So a person has to earn a right to your story, right? A person, you don't just give them everything. A person has to earn a right to your story. You go step by step.
Thank you, Elizabeth. I'm really mindful that we've got just under a minute left, and these questions are they're strong questions, and I'm mindful of timing. So I was wondering whether you could give a top tip for embodiment with your practice that you could give to people attending and watching this.
Or about embodiment.
Yes.
Yeah. So embodiment, like I said, about interoception, and I teach trauma-informed yoga as a key piece to restoring trust, because if we can learn to reside in our bodies, then we can be more equipped to feel for, okay, this is what's happening in my reality. This is what's happening in my body. So then this is a key informational piece that allows me to either move forward in this social interaction, in this relationship, in this situation, or I need to take a break. I need to take a pause. I need to take care of myself. So being with your body, continuing to engage in embodied practices like the ones that we engaged in today, I think is crucial. And it's been lovely being with all of you today. I wish you all very much, a lot of luck on your healing journey, on your healing practices. So thank you, David.
Thank you so much, Elizabeth. And thank you, Thea, for being our tech host today. And I hope you will continue your journey in the Embodiment Conference. Thank you.